over Nazi Germany. Russian President Vladimir Putin was joined by 30 foreign leaders, including Chinese President Xi Jinping. He addressed the thousands of people who joined the rally.
In the last 10 years, the basic principles of international cooperation have often been ignored. We've tried to prevent the creation of a unipolar world, but we see the world again being divided into spheres of influence. This can only further destabilize global development.
Leaders of the Soviet Union's World War II allies, France, Britain and the United States, stayed away from the parade because of Moscow's conflict with the West over Ukraine.
Chancellor Angela Merkel has called on Russia to support the ceasefire in Ukraine as she met with President Vladimir Putin in Moscow. Merkel did not attend the large military parade in Moscow marking the end of World War II, symbolizing the diplomatic chill between Russia and the West. She spoke with the media on the situation.
The criminal annexation of Crimea, which violates international law, and the military conflict in eastern Ukraine have been...
And hello. If you've just joined us, please stay tuned for our regularly scheduled program of Indigenous Talk Radio with the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
You are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
Find us on the web, ang-newswire.blogspot.com.
This is APNS Public Radio.
The opinions expressed in dispatches represent the analysis of the participating editors and may not necessarily reflect the group positions of the ANG or its public news wires.
Hi, this is Zesh9 from Zesh9.com, and you're listening to the Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Okay, welcome back to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. This is the Angry Indian. We're going to discuss a subject that's really, I find really horrific, and I'd rather not have to discuss this, especially not about what's happening in my own country, in the United States. But this is a real thing. Now we all know that prison abuse, that the abuse of prisoners by prison staff, by vindictive wardens who have their own political agendas. We all know about the gang warfare in there. Well, we don't know about it. We are aware of it because of the prison porn that we're shown on cable television. So, you know, we know that jail is not a nice place, even though Orange is the New Black is doing its best to make it look cool, to make it look interesting and fun. We all know that prison is not a place to be. And since the prisons have been privatized and taken out of the state hands, we've had. So in the state of Florida, we have Rick Scott, who made it very clear when he relayed to the press that those who are politically connected will stand to benefit from the private prison industry. And CCA has been very adamant in defending their employees, saying that they would really hate to have to find them new employment, even though they've been accused of murder. They've been accused of facilitating gang activity in prisons, which, of course, ends up on the street. And, you know, we are fairly aware of this because it's in the mainstream news. But what we don't talk about too much is the fact that L.A. County has pretty much admitted that they are the largest holding area for those in the mental health field, you know, for those who need to be, you know, treated by those within mental health. You know, that has become the largest dumping ground for those with mental problems in the United States. The entire prison population from coast to coast. I've heard from people who work in the industry, people who work as corrections officers, who have told me off the record that anywhere from 60 to 70% of the people who are in the regular prison systems, be they state, be they private, are in need of medical help for their psychological issues, for their emotional troubles. They don't need to be in prison. We're actually making things worse by increasingly you know, dealing with everything. Well, when it comes to those who are marginalized and what have you, we put them in the system. Now, I've been talking too long. I want to bring in George Mallinckrodt, and he has been dealing with this lately as someone who is working within the system. He is a U.S. psychotherapist and a prisoner rights advocate. He has a book out, Getting Away with Murder, that is dealing with a particular case that, you know, is, if I understand correctly, it's just coming to the courts. But we're going to bring George in right now. And George, you know, thank you for being on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. It's been a struggle to try to get you on. And, you know, now that I have you here, you know, could you please, you know, talk about your book, Getting Away with Murder, and how this relates to the controversy that I'm bringing up, the chaos that I'm raising, in terms of, instead of helping people who have a medical problem, we're putting them into the most violent environment that you can put a human being into outside of open warfare. Why is this happening in the United States?
Well, first, it's really great to be on the show today. And, you know, what I saw when I worked as a psychotherapist in that state prison psychiatric unit where Darren Rainey was eventually scalded to death was basically an attitude of abuse from the guards. They tried to make the lives of these mentally ill men as nasty as they could make it. None of the guards in my unit had any training with how to deal with the mentally ill. So typically, when a mentally ill man would act out as a consequence of his mental illness and do something that was behaviorally unacceptable, instead of the guards having compassion and understanding that perhaps they were having an episode, they simply treated him like anybody else or worse, and they ended up abusing these people. And so, to answer your question from a little bit earlier, we are putting a tremendous number of mentally ill men and women into our prison system. That is why our prison systems nationwide are the single largest providers of mental health services. We have very few community resources so that these mentally ill people can get treatment, have a place to stay. So they're out on the streets. They end up committing a silly crime. It could be something as stupid as they're just hungry and they steal a can of soup. Police are called in. Maybe they hit the police officer. Well, okay, that's a felony. Now they're in the system. Our state prisons are no place to treat the mentally ill. I often question what I was even doing there on a daily basis. I was thinking, really, am I having any impact on any of these people in here? Because the treatment was substandard. And back in the 70s and 80s, when they were closing mental institutions, they were closing them because of widespread abuse. Well, that compares exactly to what we have in our prison systems. We're seeing widespread abuse, but of course they're not going to close the prison systems. So they better get their act together, because we're seeing more and more mentally ill being thrown into the system, and our prison systems nationwide are ill-equipped to handle that number of people.
You're from the state of Florida. Rick Scott is in the state of Florida. And I remember the press conference that he gave that I mentioned earlier, where he said that politically connected investors will stand to profit, you know, from the private prison industrial complex, which now includes, and I'm not trying to insult anybody, but, you know, illegal aliens, people who are in the United States illegally. Without papers, if that sounds better. We are now housing, in black sites no less, we are now housing transgendered people in the wrong gender facilities, where they are facing abuse, where they are facing, you know, systemic rape, you know, not just from prisoners, but from guards. We have solitary confinement. which I'm pretty certain that the majority of people who are in solitary confinement are suffering from some sort of mental illness. You know, Florida, to me, in my own mind, is the focal point, and it's besides L.A. for the simple fact that Scott went to the press and was pretty open about the fact that we're going to make sure that 98% of these beds are filled at any given time. So when you have a vulnerable population like the mentally ill, are there advocates like yourself that are in position, that are already in state, you know, are there stopgaps to prevent or ideally that are supposed to prevent these sorts of people from falling into this kind of a trap?
Yes. Well, I think that there are very few people or organizations active for this particular cause. But you're right about Governor Scott. Last year, the president of GEO, which is a company that already has maybe six prisons, private prisons in Florida, threw Scott a $10,000 a plate fundraiser. Okay, so he's very, very connected with that corporate mentality. And the scary thing is, when the business model for these corporations depends on more inmates and longer sentences, all that's going to do is fill up our prisons even more than they are already. And as you know, we have far more people in prison than any other country in the world. 25% of all incarcerated people on this planet are in U.S. prisons. And then when you consider that up to 60% of those have some form of mental illness, it's staggering. And then here's the other thing. It's estimated that 16% of all inmates suffer from severe mental illness. That could be major depressive disorder, paranoid schizophrenia, massive delusions, psychosis. And as I said before, we're ill-equipped to handle these people.
Well, let me ask you this, that, you know, let's provide some background if we can. How is mental illness viewed in the contemporary medical field in the United States? And, you know, what is the profit motive, if any, for the incarceration of such people as opposed to treatment?
Well, what happens with the mentally ill, especially the ones that are pretty severe, is they're incarcerated, their mental illness is criminalized. They get incarcerated, they get no treatment, or as in my unit, they're made worse. So when they do finally get out, they're worse off than when they went in, and they reoffend, they end up being thrown back into prison. So you see, it's this revolving door, and I've got to think that executives in these prison corporations, they're looking at dollar signs when they see an inmate, you know, on that revolving door path. And that's another, you know, here's the thing. If we don't reduce recidivism, these companies are going to continue to profit, and they will lobby legislators and ask them to be tough on crime. And meanwhile, their attorneys are often working with legislators to write laws that put more people in prison. And so we've got to reverse that. This is a horrible trend. And here's the thing. Amazingly, we're seeing this becoming a bipartisan issue. I'm going to give a shout out to a senator down here that I've been working with. His name is Senator Greg Evers. And, you know, he's an NRA darling. He's totally on the right. I mean, we probably don't agree on much, but when it comes to reforming the Florida state prison system, we are completely in alignment. We are there. And this guy, I mean, he has exceeded my expectations. He has actually visited a number of prisons unannounced. He just shows up. And for a politician, a legislator to do that, that is above and beyond. So on this issue, I've got a tremendous amount of respect for him. And when I went up to Tallahassee and met him for the first time, he talked to me for an hour face to face before the hearing that I gave a presentation for. And you know what? This is a guy who's serious. So, you know, when we're looking out there, Democrats, Republicans, whatever, we really can't look at how they are overall. We really need to stay focused on where they stand in any given issue. And this guy is the real deal.
Okay, so I hope everybody heard that man's name, you know, that particular senator's name, so they could support him on this, because he's not going to be able to do it by himself.
I tell you, and the thing that just happened recently in Florida was his committee, the Criminal Justice Committee that I spoke before, put together a pretty strong prison reform bill with an oversight commission. Then the House, the Florida House, put together their version, which basically gutted the said version. And keep in mind, both chambers are controlled by Republicans. So these Republicans ended up bickering amongst themselves. They couldn't get any agreement on the prison reform bill and a lot of other bills. And House members just left the session 3 days early with a lot of unfinished business. So, you know, it's tough down here. We're really trying hard to get them to pass meaningful legislation and do it sometime soon, because I tell you what, inmates are dying. They're being abused. It's ugly down here.
Yeah, before we take a break, if you could briefly mention the case of Rainey and perhaps your opinion on why the mainstream press has not really pursued this case as clear as it is. And tons of other, you know, unfortunate deaths in the prison system. We have a sergeant in Texas who was recently killed. He went in for a DUI. He's supposed to do 2 days of incarceration in response to a DUI charge. They hit him with 7 days when he arrived. He called his wife to say that he needed to be bailed out, I suppose. That he really needed help, because they extended his thing from it seems to be the staff at this place, from 2 days to 7 days. And somehow, this is an active duty U.S. serving sergeant, somehow right. He ends up dead. And we just saw the video last week that was publicly released. And basically, this man was beaten to death. He was killed. And they blamed it on sickle cell or some other kind of nonsense. But it turns out that they roughed this man up. So the case of Rainey, if you could go into that briefly, please.
Well, this happened. We're coming up on the 3 year anniversary of his death, which was June 23rd, 2012. He was like many other severely mentally ill men on my caseload. He was actually smearing his feces around the cell or whatnot. We've seen that before. It's expected. We don't get too excited. But apparently guards took exception to that, and they put him into a shower and locked him in. All the showers are locked, so that's not uncommon. Except that they had rigged this shower, or the handle was broken, so that they could have complete control over the water. So the guards turned the water on completely hot. And I know from having worked there, it was scalding hot. So they turn on this water and they just basically left him there. And before they ended up killing Rainey, 4 or 5 other inmates were subjected to this treatment. And it's torture. You know, you can't put a man in a scalding hot shower and scald his back and things like that. So they ended up coming back after an hour and a half or so, and Darren Rainey, he just collapsed. I mean, the water is so hot that even though he could avoid the direct spray, think of being in a room where the water temperature is 160 to 180 degrees. Just that steam alone is going to overwhelm you, and that's what I think happened to Darren Rainey. He collapsed face up in the shower. When they took him out, 90% of his skin had peeled off. I mean, that I can't even imagine what that looks like. And so, of course, the DOC, being the organization they are, immediately went into cover-up mode. And the guards had other inmates clean up the shower. And actually, this one inmate reported to the Miami Herald that he was putting Darren Rainey's skin in one of Darren Rainey's shoes, and he threw that in the garbage. So, I mean, they obliterated a crime scene. And so, fast forward a little bit, the police came in, did a report, you know, another sort of whitewash job, which is, oh, it's a criminal. It was a third-rate investigation. And the Florida Department of Corrections classified his death as an in-custody death from natural causes. And, you just can't believe that this is happening in our country, as you said. And when I found out about it, I actually spoke to two FBI agents in an interview, and I gave him all the details that my former coworker told me about they passed on an investigation.
Yeah, I mean, how do you sleep at night knowing this? You know, I mean, the people who work in that industry, how do they deal with this sort of dichotomy of morals, of ethics?
Some of these people just don't have any. I mean, I've said that the Florida Department of Corrections is riddled with sadistic, amoral sociopaths and the people who enable, support, and cover up their crimes. This is the culture within the DOC. I don't know how these people sleep at night either. I mean, I lose sleep over this, and you know, I wasn't there. I just can't stay silent about it. I'm trying to do my best to get this issue out into the national media. I mean, I've contacted, for example, an editor for Think Progress, wrote a piece recently, and they're a national organization. I'm talking to some people in the Marshall Project, and they focus on prison issues, and I'm trying to get them to write an article on this. The thing is, the more people that know about how poorly we're treating the mentally ill, and indeed other inmates as well, the greater chance we have of changing things. And, you know, when I compare this prison brutality to police brutality, prison brutality far dwarfs police brutality. Police brutality in comparison is a drop in the bucket, honestly. And that's not to minimize all the suffering of the families of Michael Brown and so many others that we just almost hear on a daily basis now who are killed and abused by police officers.
Yeah, it's a thing. And we can lead into that when we come back from this break, how this relates to police brutality in terms of African men and women, Native Americans, Spanish-speaking Native Americans, otherwise known as our Latino brothers and sisters, how this relates to immigrants who are coming from, you know, Spanish-speaking countries as opposed to immigrants, say, from France, right, or from Canada. You know, how these disparities and how they're being treated when they're being held, when they're being detained, and, you know, how we relate to the mentally ill in these cases as a society. I mean, I have a lot of things I want to ask when we come back. This is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Please stay tuned. We're having a conversation with U.S. psychotherapist and prisoner rights advocate George C. Mallinckrodt. You know, please check out his work, georgemallinckrodt.com and at Gio Mallinckrodt. We're going to link to all of this when we publish this show, of course. He is the author of Getting Away with Murder. And we're discussing right now the Rainey case, but we're going to talk about some, you know, pretty dark subjects when we come back from this break. So this is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio, the official broadcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service. Stick around.
This is Radio Anglo-Indian. Anglo-Indian Radio for the Fourth World.
Thank you. Radio Insurgente, la voz de los sin voz.
Vamos, 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 vamos adelante, para que salgamos en la lucha avante, porque nuestra patria grita y necesita de todo el esfuerzo de los zapatistas.
Transmitiendo desde algún lugar de las montañas del sureste mexicano, en la frecuencia 97.9 en FM.
Hi, I'm Buffy St. Marie. We have overcome many obstacles in our history as Aboriginal people. We've survived. Today, we must work together, become leaders in the fight to stop the spread of HIV/AIDS in our communities. We have to think about the 7 generations ahead of us. It's a matter of survival.
Who will survive America? Few Americans, very few Negroes, and no crackers at all. Who will survive America? Few Americans, very few Negroes, and no crackers at all.
Who will survive America? Very few Negroes, no crackers at all.
Prints on the pavement. Grease was melting in this brother's eyes. His profile was shot up by a seam, but thinking it was coming around the corner was really Tony Curtis, and not a misguided brother got his mind hanging out with our Italian. Who will survive America? The black future will. You can't with the fat stomach between your ears, scraping nickels out the inside of nigger daydreams. Few Americans, very few Negroes, maybe no red Negroes at all. Who will survive America? Who will survive America? The stiff back chalk lady Baptist in blue lace, if she shrinks from blackness in front of the church, following the wedding of the yellow robots, will not survive. She's old anyway, and they're moving her church in the wind. Old people, no. Christians, no. First Negroes, be invisible to truth. 1944 Minnesota, no, no. Nothing of that will be anywhere. It will be burned clean. It might sink and steam up the sea. America might, and no Americans, very few Negroes will get out and no crackers at all. No crackers at all. No crackers at all. No crackers, no crackers at all. But the black man will survive America. His survival will mean the death of America. Survive, black man. Survive, black man, black woman too. Survive, black man, black woman too. Black woman too. Black black woman. Let us all survive. Who needs you? Let us all survive. Let us all survive. Let us all survive. Who needs you? Okay, okay. We wish each other good luck.
Hello, I'm Carol Warden. The Native American Women's Health Education Resource Center asked for your help in spreading awareness of the National Public Awareness Campaign for the availability of Plan B within Indian Health Service. Plan B is an emergency contraceptive that is routinely denied to Native women at IHS facilities. Although Plan B has been available without a prescription for adult women since 2006 and as of 2009 available to women age 17 and up, it is still not provided over-the-counter at 90% of IHS pharmacies. Our goal is to ensure that Plan B is available as an over-the-counter contraceptive for all Native women and to incorporate access to Plan B into standardized sexual assault policies within IHS. We also seek to inform Native women of their right to Plan B so that they are able to make informed decisions regarding their reproductive health. Please help us get the word out. Native women are entitled to the same level of health care as all other women. This message is brought to you by the Native American Women's Health Education Resource Center.
Broadcasting from North Jefferson County, Kansas, smack dab between Kansas City, Topeka, Lawrence, Atchison. Easiest way to describe it. Put together quite a good show. Think you're going to like it.
Radio Free Kansas on blogtalkradio.com/fightingcockfire.
This is Kristen Hirsch from Throwing Muses, and you're listening to a podcast released under a Creative Commons license.
This is FSNN reporter MJ Del Valle in Tbilisi, Georgia. Free Speech Radio News has been an essential outlet for my stories from the Caucasus region, including in-depth looks at the recent Armenian presidential election, the creative ways protesters in Azerbaijan are using to fight for freedom of expression and labor struggles in the Republic of Georgia. But FSRN, along with the voices of people struggling for dignity, equality, and human rights, could be silenced. Find out how can you support independent grassroots journalists at fsrn.org.
I'm so thirsty for revolution. I'm so crazy about the people. We're going to stand together. We're going to have a black army, a Mexican-American army, an alliance in solidarity. We're going to have some progressive whites. All of us. And we're going to march on this pig power structure. And we're going to say, stick them up, motherfucker. We come for what's ours. Up against the wall. Power to the people. Thanks, brother.
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Okay, this is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Welcome back. We're still speaking with U.S. psychotherapist and prisoner rights advocate Joel C. Mallinckrodt. He is the author of Getting Away with Murder, which discusses prison abuse in the United States within the state of Florida. Now, some of you who, I hope all of you who listen to Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez on democracynow.org, you know, you are aware, at least more aware than those who watch the mainstream media and who are limited by that, of the, you know, lack of rights within the U.S. prison system. And as our guest mentioned, no other country in the world detains as many people as the United States. Nobody. This is the land of the free, brothers and sisters, but, you know, you are not free here. You know, I mean, we've spoken to police officers who have told us that, you know, every 3 hours, basically, you break a law. And that is not your fault. It's just that there's so much litigation in the United States. It's pretty much impossible to not do something that doesn't offend the state. So really, it's the state that decides on whether or not it's going to prosecute you, on whether or not it's going to punish you. Because we live in a punitive world. So, you know, we're living in a country that believes in punitive everything. Preemptive war, preemptive detention. You know, I mean, you're guilty before you're found innocent. You know, even though we're told that it's in reverse. So, you know, going back to our guest, you know, we really want to understand, you know, if we can, the whole of it and why the average United States American citizen might be aware of a case like this where someone is burned to death, where his skin is put into his shoes and then thrown in the rubbish. How this can go on while we're talking about freedom in Iraq, freedom in Afghanistan, freedom in Yemen, right? We're supporting Saudi Arabia, which beheads people every day, right? You know, I mean, that they've been connected, literally, they've been connected in court testimony to terrorism. They've been connected financially to terrorism. They do not believe in human rights. They do whatever the hell they want to do. You know, we have, I can just go all over the board with this on the dictators that the United States supports. And then decides to go after Cuba, decides to go after this country, that country, right? And you know, and then we have maniacs that are on the U.S. payroll. Equatorial Guinea, what's going on over there? What's going on in Liberia? What's going on in Costa Rica when it comes to the drug trade? And when we talk about prisons, we have to talk about the drug trade. Every major Mexican cartel leader that they've gotten recently has been connected to the L.A. prison system. So we're creating gangs. We're increasing their membership. We're increasing the gangsterism. We're increasing the thievery. And we're also increasing the mental illness. Anyone who has known anyone that has done any significant amount of time knows that that individual, except in very rare occasions, comes out the same. I've never known anyone that went into the military that came out the same. And I've never known anyone that went to prison that came out the same. I have known people who have literally lost their minds. They never got back on their feet mentally or emotionally because of what happened to them and what they saw in there and the powerlessness. Because when you get in there, you know, let's be honest, you got the state structure, but the gang system, that runs everything. And the prison employees are involved in it. If they were not involved in it, it could not continue. So we're talking about people who already having struggles, personal struggles. And then, you know, they're in there for things that they may not really be responsible for. I mean, we have a lot of folks who have Tourette's, and I'm sure my guests can attest to this, who have Tourette's. Tourette's syndrome, you know, it causes people to act oddly. And if you somewhat recognize the symptoms, like I've learned to, and I realize that, oh, that person's not just crazy. That person has a problem. They have Tourette's. So when he or she says certain things, you really need to ignore it. Well, if they got a problem, they need to tell us. No, how are they supposed to tell you? So that you can freak out? You know, just deal with it. The person has a problem. Let's deal with it. Now, I've learned to deal with it. And I'm not saying it was easy. It scared the hell out of me when I first saw it. You know, I learned to I educated myself. I learned to deal with it. And in turn, I've learned to recognize some things. And I at least raised the question. But we're living in a society now that does not give a damn about the poor. It doesn't care about women. It doesn't care about minorities. We're living in a fantasy world that calls itself a fucking democracy. And now I went on a tangent right there, but I believe that is all relative. Because when we're looking at every 28 hours, when we're looking at a Trayvon Martin case, a Walter Scott case, and then we see, you know, had the barbarity of that. So if what our guest is saying is true, and I believe him, that if this is barbaric, what the hell do you think is happening in the prison system where people who can't defend themselves in any way, shape, or form, where they are being physically abused, they are being sexually abused? And anybody who, again, who's ever done time knows, can tell you, the majority of your time is spent playing mind games. Predators and prey. And then you have the state facilitating this. And I'm sorry, George, for going on like this. But okay, let's get to your book, Getting Away with Murder. You know, what is the basis of it? You know, what were you trying to relay to the public in this? And what has been the response from the media? And I really want to say this, the New York Times.
Okay. I wrote that book. I started writing that book soon after I met with the FBI agents. I was getting nowhere in trying to get Darren Rainey justice. So I thought, you know what? I'm going to write a book about my experiences so that people can read what is happening in a psychiatric ward in a Florida state prison. And this is not just happening in, you know, my one ward, because from the Miami Herald articles, this was happening in psychiatric wards across the state. So my book details the nearly 3 years that I worked in that ward. You know, I came in from basically a very sort of mainstream private practice type of situation. I worked for the school system for a couple of years. And so I kind of had mainstream type jobs. And when I got the prison gig, I had certain expectations. I had heard, for example, that prisoners get, you know, 3 meals a day and free health care. And I was like, oh, okay, I guess, you know, it's not bad. You know, but once I got there, I realized that the health care was horrible and the food that they were feeding these guys was just abominable. I mean, you wouldn't feed your dog the kind of food that they're feeding these inmates, this soy concentrate stuff that would be in at least 10 meals a week. It was horrible. And so despite that, I tried to do my best to treat the inmates on my caseload. And I can count, I saw literally hundreds, maybe 300 to 400, maybe even as many as 500 inmates on my caseload during that 3 year period. And I can count on one hand the people that I thought I helped. It was that bad. And in a couple of cases, well, actually more, guards actually sabotaged the progress that I had made with inmates. This one inmate in particular, he was diagnosed schizoaffective, which is a pretty severe diagnosis. And I worked with him, and typically they isolate. So he didn't want to come out of his cell. I got to the point where I got him out of the cell for individual counseling sessions, group counseling sessions. He was going to rec. He had improved dramatically. And I thought that I had rescued him from the brink of permanent mental illness. I mean, he was that close. And so one day he's going out to rec, and one of the guards apparently had an issue with something in his pocket. So I guess some sort of altercation ensued, and my inmate, who only weighed maybe 140 pounds, he was grabbed by two guards that were probably outweighed him by 250 pounds. He was slammed to the concrete floor head first. They opened a big gash on his forehead. It required stitches. I came in that Monday, and I heard about it from the other inmates in the unit who had seen what happened. And I could see there was blood on the window. There was blood on the floor. And I went over to this guy's cell, and he was under the covers, and he wouldn't come out at all. And so then later on, maybe about a month later, they were taking him to medical. And I went over just to say hello, and they had his hands cuffed behind his back, and he lowered his shoulder and ran right into me. I mean, he attacked me. So these guards don't realize that their behavior impacts other people. They made the unit less safe for me. And in another case I had, where I'd made really great progress with a guy, this one particular guard would go by his cell and torment him on a daily basis. And I tried to work with this guy. Hey, you got to ignore it. I gave them a lot of strategies, but, you know, it's tough for these guys. They don't have the greatest coping skills to begin with. And so they'd go back and forth, and the guard would write up a disciplinary report and just make this guy's life hard. So one day, they're moving him to another cell, and the guard who antagonized him had a box of the inmate's belongings in his hands. In other words, both hands full. So my inmate saw the opportunity, hauled off, punched this guy in the nose as hard as he could, broke the nose, blood everywhere. And again, what these guards don't seem to get is that when they treat inmates poorly, when they dehumanize them, when they disrespect them, they're going to eventually fight back. I mean, you can only kick a dog so long before it's going to bite you. And so that was pretty much a common occurrence in my unit.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that you had to even see that. But in the other sense, I'm glad that you did see it. And I commend you for your honesty and your integrity, you know, because the retaliation from the state, for those of us who are old enough to remember the Frank Serpico case, is real.
Right, and, right. One more note about the book for your listeners. And this book is not all doom and gloom. At the core of the book, at the center of this book, is a friendship that I developed with my coworker that I call Carmen in the book. I'm not using her real name because she fears retaliation. But Carmen and I, we clicked right away. And the best way I can describe Carmen is a tall Whoopi Goldberg. She is absolutely the funniest woman I know personally. And I tell you what, if any of your listeners out there know Whoopi Goldberg, you got to get my book to her, because I'd love Whoopi to do this movie. And, you know, to have an A-list person behind this cause would be, you know, the whole idea is to get more people aware of this. And if Whoopi Goldberg signed on in a big way and took up this cause, it would help us. It would help a lot of inmates out there that are getting abused, who have no voice. It could really work wonders. But anyway, for you people out there thinking of buying this book, I'm telling you, a lot of people are telling me they can't put it down. They pick it up and they say, even though it's kind of a gloomy subject, I couldn't put it down. So that's the way this book reads.
Well, we're definitely going to link to it, because I think people should check it out. You know, I've read the synopsis, and it's pretty strong. So as I was mentioning earlier, you know, police brutality. Now, every 28 hours, an African in the United States is executed by either police or a white vigilante who claims to be working on the side of God, because that's what George Zimmerman literally said. So we're still in the state of Florida now. George Zimmerman said God wanted him to do what he did. You know, I've mentioned it before, the society that we're living in. We have every 28 hours, we have more than 1,400 or at least 1,400 acknowledged indigenous women who are missing from the Canadian-American border. We have Native women who are missing in these man camps in the Dakotas that have set up for these new fracking towns. We have more than 2,000, the last time I saw a count, indigenous women who are missing from the Canadian-Mexican border. You know, on the Mexican side, they're working for American companies. They go to work, they don't come home, they find their bodies in the desert. There was retaliation in the form of a woman who was a serial killer. She was killing men along the border towns because of the lack of anybody doing anything at all about these women missing. On the American side of the border, you know, you have people who are border patrol who are executing. Democracy Now! Reported not too long ago, it was about 3 or 4 years ago, a man that was beaten to death on film, begging for his life by several border officers. Border Patrol officers. It's a goddamn nightmare out here. And you know, what is it about a society? You know, let's go into Foucault for a minute. You know, what is it about a society that will treat its minorities above board, in open view, on video, in front of cameras, in front of the press even sometimes, and they'll arrest the press in many cases if they report on their treatment of the public? And then we have what you're talking about, the sub-world. The unseen world. You know, this is a country that produces black sites overseas, in Poland, in Libya, but then has black sites for, you know, not just the immigrant population that they call themselves trying to get a handle on. We're, you know, black sites in the United States for that. Chicago has a black site, Holman Square. And this is all coming out after Chicago is going to pay... risk to me is a paltry sum, $5-some-odd million in restitution for people who were treated totally the way you're describing by John Berg, who, if I remember correctly, kept his pension, is already out of prison. He didn't do the full time he was served, which was a paltry bid to begin with. It was less than 4 years. He didn't do anywhere near that. People are treating him like he was a victim, but there are men who did 18, more than 20 years who were totally innocent. You know, so what kind of society is this? You know, Albert Woodfox, 40 years in solitary in the state of Louisiana because the warden there says that he refuses to let him go until he renounces the Black Panther Party for self-defense. That is the only reason why he's being held. Three different courts have called for his release already. But this warden is being allowed by the federal government to decide how long this man is going to stay in solitary and how much longer he's going to do time. So, you know, I'm sorry for being long-winded, but, you know, what sort of world are we looking at here that makes these kinds of things possible that you would even have a book like this to write?
Yeah, it's pretty incredible. And I was on a radio show with Mark Clemens, and he was one of the people that Chicago detectives beat until he gave a confession. And, you know, that we live in a country like this is just unbelievable. But the culture of these organizations, for example, the Florida Department of Corrections has a culture of corruption, retaliation, brutality, and secrecy. So American citizens, basically, you know, we just don't want to hear about this kind of stuff. So that's I think is the primary reason why all of this is still continuing. The fact that people just don't realize what's going on. You know, if you shine a light in the darkness, there's no more darkness. And so this is what I'm trying to do as one individual. And I know there are other people out there like yourself who are trying to illuminate this and show people from America, hey, this is happening here. So we need to stop pointing our fingers at these other countries and saying, oh, look at this human rights thing over here. Let's take care of our own business first. Let's clean our house first before we point fingers overseas.
So as a final question, let me ask you, what would your advice be to other professionals who are working within the system? Be they psychotherapists, psychologists, medical professionals, corrections officers, advocates, you know, how best can they, you know, do their jobs? How best can they be allowed to do their jobs and to represent the interests of the public by representing the rights of these prisoners?
Well, I think it's so important for people to stand up and speak out. When it's only a few people like me and other people, they find a way to get rid of you because they're just so few of us that are standing up and trying to do the right thing. But I tell you what if 100 guards, 100 good guards, 500? I mean, we got 16,000 here in Florida, 16,000 guards. So what if 1,000 of them stood up and say, hey, we've seen abuse. This sergeant does that. This lieutenant does this. The major, he's looking the other way. He condones abuse. We got to get these people out and encourage them to come forward. so that this can stop. The only way you're going to change a culture in an organization like the Florida Department of Corrections is to weed out these people that have condoned this evil. You know, it's not enough to just arrest a few people at the bottom, you know, that are actually doing abuse. We've got to go after the people that look the other way, who signed off on false reports, who actually put together programs to keep inmates in their place. One of the regional directors here, when he was a warden, put together something called the program, where they would abuse inmates by gassing them with tear gas and pepper spray, and you know, all in the guise of trying to control the prison. The thing that these guards don't realize is that if you respect a man, the man is going to respect you. And I tell you what, there are so many inmates who they just told me straight out, look, I deserve to be in here. I did the crime. Very few inmates came over to me and said, oh, I'm innocent, you know, and they play that card. They took responsibility for the most part. All they want to do is serve their time. And, you know, if we provide training for them, in other words, things like electric or plumbing or other jobs that pay better than a psychotherapist, you know, these people could get out in the world and make a difference and turn their lives around. But I tell you what, I did a quick survey of vocational programs in the lower region down here in South Florida. Only half of them had any vocational programs at all. So, there are a lot of ways we can make improvements. And for me, the primary improvement would be to keep people out of prison in the first place, especially the mentally ill.
Okay, I can't agree with you more. All right, everyone. That's U.S. psychotherapist and prison rights advocate George Mallinckrodt. And I really want you to check out his book. It's available on Amazon, and we're going to link to it, Getting Away with Murder, where he's really discussing this demi-world of the mentally ill and the struggle that they face within the U.S. prison system. And it is a struggle, and we should be discussing this more. And George, you know, really, it was a struggle just to get you on the show. But, you know, we finally were able to do this. And thank you. Really appreciate you for coming on, because a lot of people really need to hear what you have to say. You've been on HuffPo recently. You've been on a few channels. And I hope the mainstream media is willing to talk to you. I really hope that you can get past that glass ceiling.
Yeah. And thanks for having me on your show. And for any of your listeners who are out there who can put me in touch with national media outlets, it could be a news producer or so on and so forth, reach out. You know, I'm willing to go anywhere for an interview. I am dedicated to getting this mission out there. And also, I do want to say I have a GoFundMe campaign going, because this is full time for me and it's an unpaid position. So I'm looking at getting some private funding until I can go after maybe MacArthur grants or other sorts of grants to keep this work going. This is my life right now, trying to make a difference out there.
All right, folks, go and visit his site, georgemallinckrodt.com, and do what you can. Okay, this is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Please stay tuned.
Listen to Angry Indian Radio. He is not only for Indians, but he is also for blacks and other minorities. And they have done a lot on the problems in Palestine and also the problems of blacks. And so I recommend that you listen to them.
Roseanne Cash for the American Association of Diabetes Educators.
Johnny Cash was my dad. For years, he had diabetes but ignored it, even as his vision and health slipped away. Diabetes is serious. It can steal your sight, your limbs, even take you away from the people who love you. But it doesn't have to be this way. If you have diabetes, test and control your blood sugar regularly. You'll be healthier and you'll feel better too. To learn more, visit healthywithdiabetes.org.
Hey everybody, it's Dr. Vibe, the host and producer of the Dr. Vibe Show at thedrvibeshow.com. At our show, we do conversations and provide information for black men and those who love them. So come check us out. Also at iTunes, and also selective episodes are featured at the Good Men Project, one of the most viewed websites in the world for men. So find out about black men and those who love them at the Dr. Vibe Show.
Would you like to hear the lie that judges tell jurors every day?
Listen up. This matters. I'm Lewis Black, and this is the Civil Liberties Minute with ACLU attorney Bill Newman.
In a criminal case, the judge instructs the jury, you decide the facts, but you jurors must apply to those facts the law as I explain it. And if the prosecution has proven the defendant's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, then you must return a verdict of guilty. The problem with this instruction? It's not true. It's not true at all. And the judge well knows that, but most jurors don't. Jury nullification, the right of jurors to say no, to just say no to a prosecution, was central to the Bill of Rights. Indeed, Thomas Jefferson famously believed that jurors' right to nullify was central to democracy. Writing in the Champion magazine recently, criminal defense attorney Patrick Barone cautions that care must be taken when considering nullification because juries can use that authority to enhance and augment the power of the elite rather than to limit it. But, Barone continues, jury nullification can and should be a critical limitation on legislatures bent on promulgating and judges bent on enforcing ever more overreaching criminal laws. The take-home lesson here, criminal juries should know of their right to nullify because that power can constitute liberty's last defense.
The Civil Liberties Minute is made possible by the American Civil Liberties Union because freedom can't defend itself.
This is Radio Intelligente Rindigina.